Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 30th, 2012. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. And our topic for today is hyperinflationary doom, or we go with Glass-Steagall. And that means we go up and out of the current depths and of the financial inferno. We're burning here in the United States, too, with the heat, but I don't mean to joke about it. We are in a breaking point moment. There have been developments over the last 72 hours in the transatlantic area. There was I think it's the 20th summit of heads of state that took place in Brussels. In Germany, there was the parliamentary debate, very brief, but then was voted up yet more authorization. We're going to hear about this, but for bailout and mechanisms for austerity. But this is the end of the line. Now, first, let me mention some logistics. I want to invite our guests, and then we'll get to introduce the discussion. But the logistics are that there was, due to lightning storms in the mid-Atlantic region, the power is out, and we have a guest on with us from near Washington, D.C., Paul Gallagher. I'm glad to welcome you, Paul.
Hi, Marcia. Good to be on.
And Paul will be on by cell phone for the first part of the hour because the connections aren't possible with the electricity outage. We understand there was a peak outage of 3 million. Now it's down to 1 million, and they're working on it. But this had to do with weather patterns, but we also have other problems that it symbolizes. However, I'm very glad in the transatlantic discussion here that we have direct from Germany, speaking to us from Wiesbaden. We welcome Rainer Appel. Hi, Rainer.
Hello.
And Rainer, good. The gentlemen can hear each other. The connection is good. And Rainer is our EIR online, our bureau in Germany. I think, Rainer, you're our Berlin bureau chief, if I'm not mistaken. But you'll have a lot to say about what the government is or isn't doing in Germany, I'm sure.
Well, I hope, yeah.
So because of the timing, I was going to, Paul, because of the constraints and your time and the cell phone connection, why don't we start with you? I'd like to ask you if you want to introduce the question of, and bring any specific you wish to, about the reality of the hyperinflationary doom if we don't succeed in this radical break with that whole trend and impetus for it with Glass-Steagall, especially because I want to remind our readers for EIR Online, that's LaRouchePub.com, where you're logged on or you're listening, that Paul has an article in the latest it's the June 22nd issue called London Hyperinflation Policy Opposed to Glass-Steagall. So, Paul, why don't you introduce the situation we face right now?
Well, if I were probably better advised to do it from the standpoint of the United States economy first, because obviously we're about to be hit with money printing on a potentially immense scale by central banks, including our own Federal Reserve. And if you look at the condition that the United States economy is in, it is a dead economy right now. There has been no recovery, as everybody who's in the mass unemployment in the United States knows. There has been no recovery in more than 4 years from the financial collapse of 2007-08. If the number of people who had left the workforce in despair here in the United States were still being counted as unemployed, and there are about 5 million of them during Obama's presidency, if they were still being counted as unemployed, we would have unemployment between 11 and 12% officially in this country. And from that, it's very clear that there has been no recovery whatsoever over the past 5 years, and particularly over the the last 3 years of claims by President Obama that somehow an automatic private sector recovery was lifting up the U.S. economy. Two-thirds of the jobs that have been created in the recent 18 months have been either temporary jobs or part-time jobs or both, jobs without benefits, jobs with low wages. The majority of them actually fall below the official government definition of a low-wage job. And people are constantly running from temp and part-time jobs to jobs, trying to keep themselves employed in what they know is an atmosphere of gradual elimination of their retirement funding capabilities, their retirement saving, elimination of parts of their health care coverage and so forth, and they're desperate. So this is, you know, you have construction down 2.5 million employment since 2007. No, absolutely dead sector. Manufacturing was expanding for a little while. Now that expansion has stopped during this past spring. And you can go on through the number of young people who have not entered the workforce at all, are kind of hiding in college or hiding on their friends or parents' basements. I go through all this because when an economy like this is then subjected to large-scale printing of money by the central bank in that economy, what's going to happen is hyperinflation will be triggered at some point. That's what did it in Germany in 1923, a devastated economy loaded with debt, where the government began simply printing money to pay those unpayable debts. And after a year and a half of apparent quiescence, all of a sudden hyperinflation. And that's what we are threatened with, and threatened particularly on the basis of what appears to have been set in motion at the European summit this weekend. So, you know, already implicitly our Federal Reserve is involved in what they agreed to do in terms of money printing at that summit. And we're in grave danger and have been from the plans of Secretary Geithner and Bernanke, Obama himself, for this kind of hyperinflationary money printing. Glass-Steagall's the way to stop it, but I think we have to be clear that that is what is likely to be about to happen. So,
right. Just because of the time, Reiner, if you want to have Paul bring anything out, please intercede that way and ask. And otherwise, Paul.
But he knows more directly what you know, what came out of the summit.
Right. Do you want to summarize the last 36 hours, Reiner, for our transatlantic people especially?
Well, the new development is that we already had, before the summit, we had, how you call it, a hyperinflation behind the curtain, because all these bailout programs, they add up to something between 3 and 4 trillion euros in continental Europe. It's just that this has not been put on the table for the citizen to pay directly. So the inflation is, the hyperinflation is hidden. But before the summit, the situation has been that these bailout programs have had a certain limit, and now with the permanent stability mechanism, as they call it, which is a wrong term because it creates instability. The permanent bailout fund, it should be called the sky's the limit, or not even the sky, because we have an open end of this bailout machine. It shall be permanent, i.e., some people say it should be eternal. And that's also the governing or the governor's council of this European stability mechanism is to be unelected, not responsible to any political control, liable in terms of juridical procedures, i.e. you cannot take it to court. It would reign there like a king or an imperator. And that's naturally a very strange thing. So with this construct, they believe, the Europeans of the transatlantic system believe that they can solve all the problems. They can produce trillions and trillions they need for the bailouts, which we all know is very hopeless. But they still have the illusion somehow this system can be saved by just printing these trillions. And here we are at the very beginning of real hyperinflation. It will be felt very very soon also for the normal citizen. You have to know that that inflation for the official statistics don't tell the true story. Inflation is already quite visible here for the normal citizen in terms of the price increases for the daily daily goods that you consume, food, electricity, gasoline, and so on. They have seen vegetables and so on, meat. They all have seen price increases of 10 to 20%, even in Germany, also in France, in particular in the European South and in Ireland, where we have the most problems of the European economies. Inflation is much higher, 50% or more. So European-wide, however, you have a picture of inflation between 10 and 20% already. No, it has come in certain steps, but soon we will reach the point that hyperinflation can be expected, where you have weekly price increases of 10% or 20% or 30%. So here we are. Then at another point, it will just explode with the new bailout packages. So that's what they decided. Certain details of what they want to do have not yet been decided yet. They will talk about it over the next weeks and months, but that's no reason to lean back and say it's not so bad as I feared. It's already bad enough and will get much worse. That's the situation.
Right. Let me interpose right here. To both of you, you may have seen or not, in the last 24 hours, Lyndon LaRouche issued a statement to governments, to leaders in the transatlantic. It's dated June 29. I ask everyone listening to look on LaRouchePub.com, or it's the headline on the Political Action Committee, LaRouchePAC.com. I don't have the statement here in front of me to read some of it, which I wouldn't do on air, but it's a very short, hard hinting that it is in a statement from LaRouche personally that we want to get out, that this is insane to ratify, to continue, to carry out the authorization for these kinds of policies that you've just discussed, that ruin the basis for people's existence and for the base and the basis for the future.
And well, Marcia, one thing that's critical about that statement from LaRouche.
Yes.
There's a lot of everybody's reading the entertaining, somebody called it Oprah Buffo, stories about how the Italian Prime Minister Monti was going to slit his throat, and the Spanish Prime Minister was refusing to leave the room until the Germans agreed to the bailout. Not at all. Not at all. This immense new bailout, which got set in motion over the weekend, LaRouche makes very clear, was done by the British government and elite, banking elite in London, the Obama administration, and the complicity of the government of Hollande in France. That's who did it. And, in recent 2 weeks, there's been plenty of discussion, both if you talk to members of Congress and their staffs, as I've been doing in that period, also if you read financial press, there was plenty of discussion of the fact that a bailout deal was being done for a huge new bailout of Eurozone government bank debt. And this came from the British immediately after the G20 summit, so that's already more than 10 days ago. the British press and the British press alone at that time carried stories saying there was an agreement at the G20 10 days ago, more, 2 weeks ago. There was an agreement in Mexico at that meeting for a $1 trillion bailout of Eurozone bank debt. And even though that was denied the next day by German government sources, that was the drive that was on. And this is a typical tactic of the British to announce that what they are demanding has already occurred.
Yeah.
You know, as part of the drive to break resistance to it. And I noticed yesterday that there was a Brussels bureaucrat, I think the European Union ambassador to the United States, was interviewed on an American radio program yesterday. And he said that Chancellor Merkel of Germany had been made aware, as he put it, that as of Monday we were going to be facing an out-of-control situation, meaning as of the day after tomorrow now, we were going to be facing an out-of-control situation in the financial market unless they agreed on this bailout at this weekend's European summit. The pressure was from the British, from the Obama administration, from the president personally, who was calling European leaders, not calling Merkel, as far as we know, calling the others and organizing this pressure drive going into the summit to make sure that a huge bailout would be agreed upon. And we can go back a year, and the U.S. Treasury Secretary in the summer of 2011 was over inviting himself to the meetings in Europe. He wasn't invited, but he invited himself. And he went to the finance minister's meeting, and he said, you need a huge firewall. You need a super bazooka bailout. You need a leveraged, giganto bailout. That's what we want you to do, meaning we, Obama, and we, the British, are demanding that you do. And at that time, both the French government was with the German government in resisting that. Now that has changed with the socialist president of France flipping over to the to act with Obama and Cameron and Osborne and the British banks to demand this. So it should be absolutely clear, as Lindsay says, this was a British plan. They forced it through over this past weekend. There are details that they claim are still being worked out, but this is not just a bailout. This is a multi-trillion-dollar bailout. And you notice that the way they are describing it is they're saying now the Europeans are going to do exactly what the United States did in 2008, late 2008 and early 2009, which was a multi-trillion-dollar bank bailout using the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and the FDIC. Well, and then they say, you see how well that worked. Well, we know how well that worked. We have an economy that where officially the employment should be recorded as 12%, you know, where young people are massively 50% unemployed. It worked just great, and it's going to produce the same kind of effects in this case, but in addition, hyperinflation. So that should be clear, and that's what we've been, I know that we've been driving it at members of Congress, both that I've been involved in and other people have been on the Hill, that this bailout that's coming at you is from the British and it's from Obama. And it's not a matter of intricate, you know, conflicts among European states. That's where it's coming from. It's going to be in the multi-trillions. And that money is going to be being printed at the same time by the Federal Reserve. So it is another U.S. bailout of Eurozone banks at the same time through the Federal Reserve, unless we stop it.
Right. Paul, speaking of stopping it, I want to ask you to speak some more, because if you have a constraint on the phone and your time, about the pushback, about the responsiveness in recent weeks. There was something of a breakout of attention and demand for Glass-Steagall for intervening to stop the bailouts. And you've been directly involved in that. Do you want to summarize some of that?
Well, there is a real mass demand for Glass-Steagall now, and it's felt in Congress. I mean, it's a, it's a disastrous situation in that in the Congress in one respect, and that is that we that the White House has been able to intimidate and threaten certain senators to prevent the introduction of this bill in the Senate, which now has so many sponsors in the House. And the dynamic is very difficult to push forward in the Congress without a bill in the Senate, without Glass-Steagall introduced in the Senate. So, we have experienced directly that that is arm-twisting by the Treasury Secretary personally and threats from the White House personally, and advice, quote-unquote, from Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chief, personally to members of Congress. But against that, they are quite aware that whereas a year and a half ago it was not exactly a subject of dinner table conversation, now there is real mass support for Glass-Steagall, and it keeps coming out in all the newspapers, and they're receiving resolutions from labor unions almost weekly. There are new major labor unions, most recently the laborers and the sheet metal workers nationally have publicly endorsed the House bill, H.R. 1489, and they're getting this, and they're also getting it from the business community. And in the recent couple of weeks, there have been two public strong calls for Glass-Steagall from the vice chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Thomas Honig, who himself just ended a stint as chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City. And behind what he's doing, many, many small business organizations, banks like independent banks in Texas and so forth, who are publicly calling for Glass-Steagall. And then you have Hispanic organizations. They know very well. There are editorials in major newspapers appearing now almost daily calling for Glass-Steagall, and many economists in their blogs and so on. So the Congress has that pressure, and the reason that people support it so strongly now is they know that it worked and avoided precisely this kind of hyperinflationary bailout disaster for 70 years. And, of course, some are experts and know exactly why it worked, but many, many more simply know that it did work and that clearly the so-called substitutes for it now do not work. So it's a real battle. Certainly every Democrat in both houses of Congress is painfully aware that there is a national mobilization for Glass-Steagall and that it's gaining a lot of support. They are also painfully aware as Democrats that their president is extremely hard against this and that their Treasury Secretary is arm-twisting them and threatening them against it. And despite that, the number of the support for it continues to grow in both the House and the Senate, even though there's not a bill there. And I think that was clear also early in the week when a lot of people were leafleting, and many were leafleting right around the Congress on it, that they feel that they're under that pressure. But if we don't, what we have stressed in every meeting that we have done in the Congress, whether it be talking to a member or whether it be meeting with a staff member, is that if Glass-Steagall is not reenacted now by the United States, we will find ourselves within 2 months at most in the middle, that is through the Federal Reserve, in the middle of a multi-trillion dollar bailout of transatlantic banks, primarily Europe, and that this is really just one bank debt crisis, which happens at the moment to be centered in the Eurozone banks, but our banks are completely unprotected from it and participating in the bubbles that are involved. And this is going to be in the trillions of Federal Reserve money pumping into these banks unless Glass-Steagall is passed. But that if it is passed and enacted in the United States, restored in the United States, then it will probably in short order be that example will be followed. It'll be enacted in major European countries as well. So,
right.
It's a very interesting debate. that's going on.
Right. Now, before, Reiner, we have a remaining half hour, and I do want to get from you, including the transatlantic back and forth on this, what, how people are watching, what it means if it's this drive in the U.S. But, Paul, one thing Glass-Steagall does, it calls the question on what credit really means. If you have the conditions where you can have financing of nation-serving projects and so forth and so on, you've been in discussions of this. I also want to mention here, people can look on LaRouchePact.com, and Paul, you were interviewed about credit and how we can move forward. June 8th, there is a video, as well as a later one on what you said at the beginning of this program. June 18, you have a LaRouchePact video on the killer unemployment that's taking place under this Obama recovery. But back to credit, do you want to say something about what in discussions with people who are really very favorable that we have to have Glass-Steagall, how, what do they think then beyond that?
Well, this goes beyond Glass-Steagall in a very natural way. It in certain ways is like a tempting carrot for those who are in the middle of the battle over their souls of whether they'll back Glass-Steagall against all this pressure. The first thing Glass-Steagall would do, aside from the famous separation of banks and other kinds of financial institutions, is it would prevent the Federal Reserve or the FDIC, for that matter, from insuring, protecting, paying off on, and so forth, any kind of securities associated with non-banks. And it's interesting that from the standpoint of Glass-Steagall regulation, virtually every major bank in Europe is a non-bank because they violate the principle. They combine everything under the same umbrella of banking, their universal bank, as they call it. So from under Glass-Steagall enforcement, they're non-bank, and the Federal Reserve cannot participate in bailing them out. That's interesting right away. The same thing applies to all of the securities-related units of all of the big U.S. banks. But, you know, you do have to look at the fact that the average large European bank right now is twice as leveraged. That is, the ratio of its debt assets to its capital is more than twice as high as the average large U.S. bank. The average large European bank is much more dependent on money market mutual funds and other hot money for its short-term financing. Not because of any difference between U.S. and European bankers, but because there's a big difference between Franklin Roosevelt and those who have governed and the banking authorities in Europe since then. They haven't had Glass-Steagall protection. They haven't had Glass-Steagall rule. So that's what put them in that position for most of that time. The U.S. banker were chafing violently under the rules of Glass-Steagall, but they were having to follow them, and it was keeping them away from the trough. So if you then stop that bailout, if you reenact Glass-Steagall, you stop the bailing out of that kind of thing, and then you can look and say, how much money has the Federal Reserve printed in order to bail out banks in the last 4 years? It's about $2.3 trillion. I'm not talking about short-term lending, overnight, 6 weeks, 6 months, anything like that. The printing of money to purchase securities for the benefit of banks by the Federal Reserve in that time has been about $2.3 trillion. That's about $600 billion a year. Now, wouldn't it be nice if you simply thought about, suppose the Federal Reserve, instead of buying the mortgage-backed securities and derivatives from the banks during this period of time, had been buying the bonds issued by a new TVA-like, Tennessee Valley-like, authority, a North American Water and Power Alliance authority, various infrastructure bonds issued by the state, issued by the cities and municipalities. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't we have an entirely different situation with employment and everything else if that national credit had been going in that direction instead of... So the the immediate idea of Glass-Steagall is that it saves the national credit of the country, of the United States in this case. And if it's not all being thrown into the Wall Street and City of London and so forth, then instead it can go into the issuance of credit for building up the economy for major infrastructure rebuilding. And believe me, that idea has tremendous currency as a follow-on to Glass-Steagall, but you have to do Glass-Steagall first.
Right. Well, Reiner, let me ask you, you've been discussing what's happening in the United States with many of the leaders in Germany or maybe elsewhere in Europe on the municipal level and the business community who are opposed to the kind of vote summary and the parliamentary vote yesterday for more bailouts and austerity. Can you say something about that?
Well, first of all, there's at least two different realities. One is the summit reality and what the governments and their experts make out of it and how they propagandize it. And the other reality is the uneasiness, outrage, discontent, opposition, which is very widespread throughout Europe. What you have, what is being done in Europe on the government level at the summits is only possible because the mainstream propaganda, which is the political elites and the mainstream media, always say, well, there's an emergency, we have to act now, we cannot wait. And there's no alternative. This is one of the most used words by Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany. There's no alternative. And that's why she also got the by name Tina, for there is no alternative.
Oh, okay.
But there is an alternative. And it's interesting to see that the mainstream press of Europe, with certain exceptions in the British press, never has any word on the ongoing Glass-Steagall debate in the United States, not a single word.
Reiner, I have to interpose one thing. I read the London Financial Times last week. The one word they had in the letters to the editor is Glass-Steagall will not work. And here's why.
Well, okay. Let's see the propaganda. I can give a very striking example. Recently, I was in Berlin for talks to parliament members and others. Other institutions, and I at one event I met the chairman of the German Banking Association, Alexander Schmitz, and so on the sidelines of the event I talked to him about the Glass-Steagall debate in the United States, and there he said, which just shows that some people are quite aware of the situation in the United States, he said, I could imagine that Glass-Steagall could return in the United States. The people are very much embarrassed and outraged at what happened, the excesses of the banks, and it may come back in the United States, but not in Europe. It will not work in Europe. It will not come in Europe. So and that's the policy. No Glass-Steagall debate in Europe. Nevertheless, the LaRouche movement has been active in numerous European countries, and the Glass-Steagall debate here is our own trademark, because for the past 3 or 4 years we have brought the issue up at numerous events with mayors, with labor unions, with members of parliament. And just another anecdote, I also recently in Berlin talked to two financial experts of the parliament at two different events, and I told them about the Glass-Steagall debate in the United States, and they did not know a single thing about it. Where should they know from? It also turned out that they had been in the United States recently, but their visits had been arranged in a way that they had no contact to any financial experts in the United States, so they never had contact to reality, so they were quite shocked. It's like telling people about a new undiscovered continent. So it's almost as if Christopher Columbus had never discovered the United States. naturally people are quite interested once they get briefed. And recently, for example, in the German Social Democracy, some middle-level experts in the parliamentary group have offered a paper endorsing Glass-Steagall, also with a lot of documentation on the original Glass-Steagall. So you see there's interest, something can be done. However, they also complained that the party executive of the Social Democrats, which is the one which is closely cooperating with François Hollande, the new socialist president of France, that the Social Democratic Party executive is blocking the issue. So they would like to have a debate, these experts, but the party top is blocking the issue, which is what I told you before, the elites are blocking that. Mm. However, there have been numerous instances where within the broad opposition to the new European bailout machine, people have made reference to the importance of having a real alternative to all these bailouts, which would be a separation of banks. And it's interesting to see that outside of ourselves, the LaRouche movement, that, for example, the Freedom Party of Austria has been quite outspoken about it. They made the issue in a mass rally in Vienna on Wednesday this week, attacking the ESM, the bailout machine, for various reasons, and then added that instead of the bailouts, what we need is something that's good for the real economy, and here we need bank separation. That's what was said by the party chairman of the Freedom Party of Austria. I also talked to the financial expert of the Freedom Party of Austria a couple of days before, because he, in an interview, had said that what we need is a separation of banks. And I asked him, well, how far would you go? Would you stop where most European politicians stop, namely not doing anything interesting on the issue? Or would you go as far as the original Glass-Steagall in the United States, on which we have a very broad and intense debate? And he said Glass-Steagall is the only approach that works. That's the real separation. And otherwise, we cannot have the banks we need for the Mittelstand companies, which are not getting any euro from the banks at this point. Especially when they're in trouble, they're not getting any cent. And this has to change, otherwise we ruin our economy. Concerning ruining the economy, you have to be aware that we already have high youth unemployment throughout Europe. Naturally, the top runner is Spain, with more than 50% of the young generation without a job. This rate of 20 to 30% in the rest of southern Europe. And also in the other parts of Europe, including Germany, the rate of increase of new unemployment is highest among the young generation between 16 and 25 years. That's also the case in Germany. So this policy is destroying the economy. Disinvestment has been there since 2008. Disinvestment because the banks are not lending money to companies, to most companies. Disinvestment has been in the range of several hundred billion euros. At the same time, the other side of the bailout coin is brutal austerity. It's naturally most brutal in Greece, Spain, Portugal, and the so-called problem countries, but it's also brutal in the rest of Europe. And it came up during the parliamentary debate in Germany on the bailout mechanism yesterday, that the austerity package, which is called the fiscal pact, which goes along with the bailout machine, amounts to 2 trillion of euros being pressed out of the economies of the states that will participate in the fiscal pact, which are 25 of the 27 member states of the European Union. The only exceptions are the Czech Republic and Great Britain are not taking part in it. The other 25 declared in January they want to go for that. And 2 trillion euros will be pressed out of the real economies of these 25 states. So,
and this is, yes, this is with every one of them is already in recession, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This is with every state already in recession.
So it means that part of the bailout, hyperinflationary bailout, will be financed, co-financed through these budget cuts in social labor market investment programs, Medicare, and so on, infrastructure programs. 2 trillion euros. That's quite a respectable sum that's being taken out of the real economy of Europe. So the Europeans apparently have no other obsession than quickly destroying themselves. This system cannot work, will not work, and it will go under sooner or later.
Yes. Do you want to add or question anything about that, Paul, that side of
things? Well, the only thing that I think is notable to add, the Helga Seplerush, the Buzo, have come out with European-wide have come out with a Mediterranean development plan, a Mediterranean Marshall Plan for development of great projects and recovery following bank separation in the countries of Europe that are most affected. And in her introduction to that plan, Helga makes very clear that the European countries, in order to implement the Glass-Steagall principle, have to go back to their own currencies. That this is not something you can do with the euro. That so-called experiment is completely exhausted. It's finished. And a country, Spain, to pick an example, cannot implement a Glass-Steagall banking reform and remain in the euro. It has to go back to the peseta, and the same is true for the other. And then it can potentially generate real productive credit based on its own currency. But in the euro, it's impossible. And you know,
that's because what we have now is just the last act in a drama that began with the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, where we had all the ingredients already there that have led to the situation we have now. So it's a step-by-step stripping of the economic and financial sovereignty of the European Union member states, and especially strong with the 17 states that are member of the Eurozone system. So here we have step-by-step stripping of the sovereignty, and the sovereignty has to come back, otherwise remobilization of the real economy is impossible. The European system, but also especially the Eurozone system, explicitly bans any state-funded initiatives in infrastructure sector. There are many infrastructure projects that have only been on paper but never come into the phase of initial realization because they are bound to strict co-financing by the respective states. Like in Greece, many of the infrastructure programs that should have been done, modernization of ports, of airports, road building, railway building, has come to a total standstill. Other things, modernization of the medical sector, hospitals, and so on. That all has been blocked because the Greek government has not been able to come up with the co-financing. And it cannot come up with the co-financing because it cannot borrow to grant loans for these programs. That's banned under the Maastricht Treaty system of 1992 already, and especially then with the euro system, which is in effect since 1999, this has worsened the situation. So the issue is not even only to get back to the national currencies, but to regain the national sovereignty in doing the things that are necessary to rebuild the economies. And this, the government's cannot do. And as I just said, they're not only not doing that, they're even going to a phase now of ultimate destruction of what is left of the real economy. And there's no way within the Eurosystem. It's as if you want to say at a very late point of the catastrophe that there's life on the Titanic. There's no life on the Titanic. From a certain point on, there's no life anymore possible on the Titanic. And here we are at this point. People have to get into the lifeboats or they go under. So as for the Southeast and South European reconstruction program, it has naturally met very much interest in the respective states, in Greece naturally, but also in Spain and Italy. We also get some responses from Portugal and Ireland. They're interested, although they're not part of Southern Europe, but it's the same paradigm they have to go to. And we're also presenting it to municipal governments, to regional governments, to economic experts and others here in Germany. And people are quite interested. So they see that that's the right approach. The only thing that's still missing is a decisive push to get rid of the Eurosystem and to get back to national sovereignty in fiscal and real economic terms. And that's what we are engaged in this battle. So I just can add that naturally in Germany yesterday, the bailout fund and the fiscal pact, which goes along with it, the destruction of the real economy, were passed with a great majority of 85% of the parliament members. So that that battle has been lost. However, we now move into another battleground, or two battlegrounds. One battleground is the public campaign, which the Lausche organization, the Büso party, are prominently involved in, public campaign to call for a national referendum on all these changes that have been decided by the government. Because they are substantial, they take away the rest of fiscal sovereignty of the parliament, the elected parliament, and that has to be voted on by the population in a national referendum. Naturally, the government doesn't want to do that. But we are increasing the pressure, and now that this atrocity has occurred in the parliament, I think more and more people will come to realize that we need a national referendum. It's the same in Austria and in many other countries of Europe, so this will move to the forefront. The second battleground, especially in Germany, is the legal front. There are probably up to 10, if not more, legal complaints against the ESM, the bailout fund, at the Constitutional Court. And although one cannot entirely count on the judges there, they have made decisions in the past that have posed certain restrictions on what the government can do and cannot do concerning European policies. So this time, a certain border has been crossed, and it can be hoped and can even be expected that a ruling will occur at the German Constitutional Court that will stop some of this insanity. That alone is not a change of policy yet. It would just stop the drive into hyperinflationary developments, slow it down, and offer some additional time to organize for the alternative. The court has already acted and told the president of Germany that he cannot sign the two treaties on the fiscal pact and the ESM for as long as the court has to look into these constitutional complaints, because some of the complaints also go along with a request for an injunction. The injunction would stop the government from paying any euro, any single euro, into the bailout fund for as long the court has not ruled on these legal complaints, and naturally that would freeze the bailout fund entirely, because without the German money, which is 27% share in it, it the fund would not be able to work the way it is designed. So here the court has given us some 2 or 3 weeks of time to increase the pressure against the ESM. And the issue has also been taken up in Ireland. There, an independent member of parliament, Thomas Pringle, has announced he will ask the High Court, it's called there in Ireland, to also have an injunction against Ireland's paying into the bailout fund. And we have a motion in the two opposition parties, FPÖ and BZÖ, in Austria, who also want to take the issue to the Supreme Court of Austria. They are also mobilizing for a national referendum in Austria. So here, these are the two battlefields for the next coming weeks, the referendum mobilization and the constitutional courts. Maybe some other countries, constitutional court actions will be taken as well now. We will see.
Right. I have an email I want to get to and ask if I hope Paul is still on.
Yeah, I'm still here.
I appreciate the cell phone, and I'm going to do that in 1 second. One thing is, it's just from this side of Atlantic, we also see that Mr. Tremonti in Italy, that is the former finance minister and statesman, has a bill in May he put into the parliament, correct? Is that right, Reiner, for Glass-Steagall action in Italy?
Yes, we have several initiatives in the Italian parliament and Senate. Already the initiative of Mr. Tremonti, who after all is former finance minister, is of special importance because this went, as far as we know, straight into the financial policy committee of the Italian parliament, and it's already on the agenda there. So that's a very important step. One has to add that we also have, outside of the La Rouge movement, the Movisol party in Italy, we also have the Lega Nord, which is a party where Giulio Tremonti belongs to. The Lega Nord also has a mobilization going to gather 50,000 signatures for Glass-Steagall, the real Glass-Steagall in Italy, and then present this along with an initiative in the Italian Parliament. So this aspect looks quite well also in Italy. I can add, although François Hollande has outed himself as to be on the other side, the side of the British financial empire,
the Tony Blair side, right?
Yeah, that within France, the election campaign of Jacques Cheminade, the La Rouge representative in France, and his Solidarité et Progrès party, the presidential campaign, and then the recent campaign for election of a new national parliament. So here, the issue of bank separation and Glass-Steagall has been put on the agenda prominently, and it has been commented in numerous articles in the press, and the issue is there also in France, because more and more people will now come rapidly to realize that their illusions about Hollande being an alternative to the policy of the former President Sarkozy are not to be fulfilled, and this will increase also the opposition in France. We had motions in the parliaments of Belgium, Denmark, and Sweden for Glass-Steagall. So the issue is here, and this will increase. But naturally, what Mr. Tremonti did is of special importance in Italy, so we would wish other former finance ministers also to come forward in the other European countries.
Right. Well, I think what this, we're in the final minutes, and I will get to this email in a few seconds. I think everything you've said has been done from the vantage point that individuals listening here, anyone you know, it's now is the time to take action, because we're really trying to force a miracle. And that's the way you do it, I'm sure, is that because we are, the break that we have to have is going against what seems to be this huge machine towards doom, but yet the individual actions in the right context can make all the difference. So it's over July 4th upcoming holidays in the U.S., but this is the last thing is to get into a holiday spirit. Instead, it's more opportunity to give marching orders to your elected officials. And Paul may want to say something out in the closeout, but what we've had, Paul, is from Chesapeake, Virginia, someone has sent an email and said, I assume you're not talking about this Thursday's Supreme Court decision about the Obama health care upholding that because it is secondary to the bailout crisis. I could answer it, but Paul, why don't you give a few words on that?
Well, yeah, I think it is secondary to the bailout crisis.
I do too.
So, I mean, I appreciate that the person who sent the email is pointing that out. It is, you know, what's number one in the news is definitely not what's number one in the fate of the country at any given time. I would just want to say that in terms of giving you an idea of how strong the support for this is and what it's up against at the same time, in the state of Washington, in the United States, the Democratic Party recently sent out a questionnaire to all of its candidates around the state, all the congressional districts, and also the state races, 95 candidates. And among the questions that they asked them was, do you support and are you campaigning for the restoration of Glass-Steagall? 95 out of 95 candidates said, yes, I am. That gives you an idea. Every single Democratic district committee in that state has passed a resolution for Glass-Steagall. So it gives you an idea. At the same time, there was a speech by Senator John McCain the other day where Bill Jones, friend of ours, asked him, what about Glass-Steagall? And he said, I'm shortening it, I'm totally for it, but I can count the votes in the Senate. The votes are not there to pass Glass-Steagall now in the Senate. Why? Because the power of the financial interests is too strong. So that was a challenge which we immediately started going with to the rest of the Senate and House. Who runs the Congress of the United States? Do the financial interests of Wall Street and the City of London run it, as Senator McCain is implying, that they say you're prohibited from passing Glass-Steagall? Do they run it? Do you run it? And we are going to now, because there was a crash about to happen in Europe, as the EU ambassador said, Chancellor Merkel became convinced that on Monday there was going to be, with the bank downgrades, with the collapse of Spanish debt, the collapse of Italian debt, there was going to be a generalized collapse. You either go with Glass-Steagall or you capitulate to the British bailout. She did the latter, but because she wasn't ready to do the former. And this means that there's now going to be a multi-trillion dollar bailout, including money printing by the Federal Reserve in the U.S., unless we stop it. And we are going to go with that now with every constituency organization and every member of Congress starting on Monday, that, you know, the second huge bailout cycle is now on, the one that triggers hyperinflation, the one that prints trillions of new money. Are you going to stop it? If you're going to stop it, you do it with Glass-Steagall. Or do you say that the financial interests have too much power here and they control what the Senate and the House do, and therefore you can't do it? And, you know, this shock from what the EU did over the weekend is a shock, which we, as unfortunate as it is, we have to use it in that way.
Yes, I would. And Reiner, we have less than a minute, but if you want to say anything about the two realities, and we're going to commit to making the truth prevail, you're quite welcome to give any closeout comment.
Well, naturally, this EU summit and then the vote in the German parliament are a Black Friday of its own kind. But I must say that the opposition to the bailout is not at all demoralized. They are quite combative. That's the general picture, even outside of the LaRouche organization. And I think that's something one can build on. We have here a new statement out by Helga Zepp-LaRouche, the party chairman, chairwoman of the BUSO, where she also likens what has happened now to the system of Versailles after the First World War, which led to the situation that created the Weimar hyperinflation of 1923, and she calls for resistance and the overturning of the system. So this statement will be going out to all members of parliament, also members of state parliament, municipal councils, and so on in the coming days, and we will see what we can do. I can only repeat, the opposition to the bailout is not demoralized. They are combative, and they will continue to fight. And that's what we shall do and will do.
Thanks. And that's the time for patriotism here, July 4th week in the United States, just what Paul and Reiner said. I thank you both from Germany, Reiner Appel and Paul Gallagher here in the United States. So this will be the closeout of June 30th, 2012. LaRouche Show, please listen next week. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Thank you.